When did you first get interested in playing bass?
I was probably about 15 years old. At the age of 8 to 10, I was studying classical guitar. Using the classical formula, I was playing bass and guitar at the same time anyway, you know. And when I started kind of doing the street thing, learning with this gentleman, Poppy, he would play guitar, but he's also a bass player, and he liked playing bass, so I would play guitar as well, you know, so we swap around, you know. You know, I got to play bass. I probably started playing bass when I was, you know, probably 12.
What was some of your favorite music growing up?
My home, my father listened to tons and tons of jazz. And then, you know, we had the radio station that we listened to a lot was WBOK. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, later the WYLD came around. Back in those days, those radio stations tend to play a great deal of New Orleans music. So, you know, I got to hear, all of the early New Orleans artists like Earl King and, you know, Benny Spellman and, mm-hmm. you know, Cato and Frankie Ford, you know, Huey Smith and the Clowns, Fats Domino, mm-hmm. you know, some Art Neville and also Fessin' Longhair, you know. Some of the Eddie Bull and stuff. So I heard a lot of that stuff, you know.
When did you first meet Art?
I first met Art. Well, I didn't really meet him. I think, and I can't remember exactly what year that was. I moved, my parents separated when me and my brother was in our early teens. We moved uptown on Coliseum Street, which was, I was in the second block from Fallon Street. On Coliseum. My little cousin Zigaboo lived on the corner of Coliseum and Valence, and in the middle of the block, Art's mother, Art wasn't living there. He was living around the corner on Camp Street. But Art's mother lived at, I think it was 1115, I believe, something like that, of Valence Street. So, you know, I never really met Art until maybe years and years later, but I knew who the Nevilles were by that time. You know? I mean, I went to school with Cyril. Cyril, my little brother, and Zigaboo was in the same classes together.
Did you guys just start playing together, jamming together?
At that point in time, I was not considered a professional player yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I was still probably honing in on what I was going to be doing, you know, later. Mm-hmm. Art was a professional at that point in time. It wasn't until I moved out of the neighborhood and we had moved uptown, up in Carrollton neighborhood, and mm-hmm. I met up with a gentleman named Herbert Wing. And I'm guessing by now I must have been 16 or so. He was like a half guitar, bass player with travel, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, whoever called, you know, he would go play the gig, sort of like what I'm doing today. One day he got a call from Art, come play a gig with him on guitar. Herbert couldn't play the gig, but, you know, I was fluent enough as a rhythm guitar player. Herbert, you know, sent me out as a guitar player. Well, at that point in time, you know, Art wasn't a soloist. You know, he was just, he played piano well enough to be his accompany what he was singing. So he depended on the guitar player, who was me at that time, to play the solos. Well, I was a terrible soloist. I played rhythm guitar. At the end of the night, man, Art told me, said, "Brad, you're a terrible guitar player. You're horrible." A couple of years later, it may have been 15 or so, because I remember about 17, I was playing at this little club with a guitarist named Irvin Bannister, and I was playing bass by then. Art came in to the club one night and saw me playing with Irvin's band. Now I'm playing bass. And at the end of the night, he approached me and told me, "See, now that's the instrument you should be playing. You want to play a gig? You want a gig?" That's basically what he kind of offered me. Now, what year that was, I can't really. Well, I mean, if I'm 17 when that happened, probably be 65. Yeah, that could probably be about right. By the time we started recording, it was 67. So that was about a year and a half later, 2 years later, that we started recording Sissy Strut and all that stuff.
What were the first songs y'all recorded as the Meters?
The first four songs we recorded was Sophisticated Sissy and Sissy Strut, Here Come the Meter Man, I believe was on the B-side of Sissy Strut. And on the B-side of Sophisticated Sissy was a thing I think they called Seahorn's Form, which was like really turkey in a straw.
Those recordings really have this sort of live sound to them. Did you guys basically record everything live? I mean, from
absolutely. Well, in 1967, it was it was pretty much recorded straight to I want to say it was straight to tape. I don't really remember. We might have been. I think we had, by that time, we were using directly to tape, mm-hmm. but it was directly to like two-track tape. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I think we had already been, you know, I believe earlier in my career, I did record a session with Irvin Bannister that Eddie Bull produced that we recorded and they cut it on this little metal kind of plaque, you know. Mm-hmm. By the time that we started recording Sissy Strut and stuff, I believe that we actually was using tape at that point, but it was like we were using these little Shure mixers. Mm-hmm. And I think Kaz had a couple of them, like two, maybe four channels of these little Shure mixers. And, you know, and that sound went straight to tape. And I may be mistaken because, you know, there were some things that we weren't privileged to. Mm-hmm. And one of the things was, at that point in time, was going into the control room. You know, we were kind of like in the studio. I was in a big room where we was cutting that, and that's where we kind of spent most of our time, you know, except we might have stepped outside the room and take a smoke or something like that.
How'd your songwriting process work as a band back then?
As a band back then, you know, somebody would come up with a single idea, you know, like a lick. Like Leo came up with Sissy Strut, and everything else was sort of like whatever the band, you know, what we did, you know. And Sophisticated Sissy, again, was Leo's idea. We were like playing Sophisticated Sissy as a break song. It never got past just, you know, the beginning of the song. You know, we were just kind of playing the pattern or the groove, you know. It didn't really have a head or a tail. Well, actually, the song never really did have a head or a tail. Neither one, Sissy Strut or Sophisticated Sissy, didn't have heads or tail. Those songs were more like rhythm tracks waiting for something to happen on top. The parts that Art played sort of like took on, you know, the heads, you know, each one of those songs, you know.
Those early tracks are more groove oriented, and did you guys sort of change your sort of songwriting approach as your careers went on?
Absolutely. By the time we had gotten into our third record, definitely by the time we got to record Cabbage Alley, which would have been the fourth record, the individual players were now, you know, bringing completed songs into the studio, you know. At that point in time, Zig and Leo kind of almost became the more primary writers in the band, and I just kept getting high.
Did you feel that drugs really took a toll on you physically and creatively? Do you feel like it made you more creative?
Drugs didn't make me more creative at all. I don't believe the drugs had anything to do with the creativity. You know, some people might argue about that. Well, let's put it this way. There's no real way to tell what I would have done if I wasn't have been on drugs, because there's absolutely no way of telling, you know, how creative I was on drugs or off drugs. I mean, I can say what I'm doing today, mm-hmm. what I'm creating today, being sober, mm-hmm. to me seems to be a lot more fruitful. Back in the late 60s and all the way up until the band broke up, I think that George Porter had maybe only contributed four songs to the recording sessions that we did. I mean, I did bring other tunes in, but they just never made it to the chopping board. Mm-hmm. you know, because when I started writing songs, you know, I was getting away from the one chord thing. I wanted to play more changes, you know, and more and stuff like that, which, you know, caused some difficulty with other players in the band. And so those tunes, you know, just kind of got looked over because it was, you know, it was too many chord changes, you know.
You want to have more going on within the structure of the songs?
Well, yeah. I just, you know, I thought that the chord formulas, you know, I was more into chord formulas. I'm talking about, it was the music that I was writing wasn't lyrical. They were instrumental songs, but songs that I was writing, you know, called for more melodically instrumentalists. I assume the band wanted to be dealing with. So, I mean, because those songs, we never recorded them, so that was the way they went. It had a lot to do with simplicity, and I understood that because, you know, ain't no sense in cutting something that you ain't going to be able to go out and play.
The whole point of recording these songs is to be able to get out there and play them.
That's exactly the truth. I mean, I wrote songs today that I can't go play. You know,
really?
But now, you know, it's because I'm singing now. You know, I'm singing and playing. Mm-hmm. You know, when I wrote originally both the bass lines, because a lot of my songs get the bass lines, you know. So I write the music around the bass lines, and then I try and write lyrics to go around what I play it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then now I'm writing lyrics that go with the song. And then after the the song is complete and I'm liking the song, then I have to sit down and figure out how to play it and sing it. And I realize that, you know, something, I can't do this. So, I mean, if I got 12 songs on a record, you know, you may only hear me play 7 of them because the other ones I can't play and sing.
You're working with so many different projects, different groups, and do you have a favorite group to work with?
Most favorite band on the planet, if it's any, if I got a favorite band to play with, it would be the Running Partners band because it's my own band and it plays my own music. You know, that would be my favorite band. But, I mean, if there was a band that I had to make up to say, well, I would have a great deal of fun would be my favorite, what you call dream band.
Mm-hmm.
Who would I have? Well, you know, I would probably put together a band that would have 2 drummers in it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, why?
You know, just because I would want to see what I would do with it. I mean, I know what a single drummer and I can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would, you know, I have not done, well, I did, I played with Buddy Miles and, I can't think of the drummer's name from Deep Banana Blackout. I played with those 2 guys. You know, the drummer from Deep Banana Blackout, we were playing these Hendrix songs, you know, so he was pretty honest to the way Buddy Miles played these tunes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like a challenging thing that 2 drummers bringing ideas to the table that a bass player would have to play to, you know. They were almost identical in the same concept because Buddy Miles is honest to what Buddy Miles did, and the other drummer was very honest to what Buddy Miles did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't challenge me as a bass player. But if I had 2 drummers that brought to the table almost 2 concepts playing together at the same time, then it would mean that I, as a bass player, would have to find some place in between those 2 drummers where I make it music look musically, because the 2, you know, the bass and drums has got to play together,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what most people think. If the bass player didn't play with the drummer, then we all just soloing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my belief. You know, I mean, everybody would, somebody else would say something different about that. But, I mean, that's my belief. I think that the bass player has to play with the drummer. He has to be a part of the drummer's left hand and his foot, you know. Mm-hmm. Whichever that snare drum, whatever hand is a snare drum on, you know, the
mm-hmm.
snare foot. The bass player has to be, he has to get off of that backbeat. He can't be in the way of the backbeat. Bottom notes have to be somewhere, you know, with coordination with the kick drum. So, you know, he has to be in there somewhere. If bass player's in the pocket with those 2 parts of the drums, then, you know, everybody else on stage has to do whatever the hell they want, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we done created the pockets for them to get in.
It would just force you to, like, balance between those 2 styles.
Exactly. I mean, it would be a challenge that I have not at this point had a chance. It may be a project that I may have to, you know, consider in the near future, you know, trying to, you know, find 2 drummers. You know, I did play a gig, Jazz Fest, not this Jazz Fest, the Jazz Fest year before last, with 3 drummers, Bigaboo, Stanton Moore,
uh-huh.
and Russell Batiste. The thing is that when you have that many drummers, it really went very well,
mm-hmm.
because all I did was I took the smallest part available, because we were playing songs. We weren't going after creating anything that hadn't already been created. We were playing meter songs, so what I did was I just took the smallest part of the song, mm-hmm. the bass lines, most of the bass lines that I had created, and played less, you know, and so
mm-hmm.
that means so that all of the energy and the statements being made by the 3 drummers, I was not in nobody's way. My thoughts is that 3 drummers is too many. I'm 2 drummers.
Mm-hmm.
I would really like to be able to refine the 2 drummer concept. And not necessarily, you know, the thing like Mickey Hart and Bill had. You know, it was like, because, you know, there was the big Mickey Hart setup, and then there was the kit player, you know. I'm thinking more like, you know, 2 actual kit drummers, you know,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, approach some music and made it a new piece of music, you know. Yeah, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, I think I'm going to do this.
It's amazing the way you're just able to sort of adapt yourself to any situation.
Yeah, I've been pulling that off pretty good. I have to be honest with this.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't just because I was a bass player. I played drums before I played guitar and bass. I played drums before that. I have a really good working knowledge of drums. You know. And I still play drums. Here at home, I don't go out and play too often. Every now and then, with PBS, every now and then, me and Russell and Brian used to swap up, and every now and then we would do it. I mean, everybody would play a different instrument, you know, and I would play drums, and sometimes Brian would play drums, I'd play guitar. Russell was kind of lean with playing bass. You know, I think he maybe once he went on guitar, but you know, we'd done that, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 times. You know, I mean, our 3 and 3.5 year period. You know.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that playing other things helps to improve your skills as a bassist?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I believe in having a working knowledge of what the other players are playing. You know, Brian always say that there was some times that me and him be playing, and we would just do something. And, you know, we just look at each other, and we did the same thing at the same time. You know, it had a lot to do with the fact that, you know, is that I'm paying attention to what's going on the stage. Nobody may not be paying attention to me, but I'm paying attention to everybody on stage. And there's cliches that happen in music. There's more cliches than we like to think about, but there's very much cliches that happen all the time. After a period of time, you know a player. You know, so when a player starts to do something that is cliche to him, that's one of his cliches, and you jump on it and you finish that cliche with him, you know, then it gets to be like, whoa, you know, how you knew that was going to happen? Well, because you do it all the time.
It seems to be really a big part of New Orleans sound because everyone plays with everyone so much.
I don't know if everybody plays as much. When I was coming up, it was, you know. There's not as much of that that bread and stuff around, because today I tend to see a lot more of my music. You know, when I say my music, I mean, you know, whoever the different bands is. If they got 20, 30 different bands in town, everybody is being sort of my original music. You know, I'm trying to present me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go sit in with somebody, you don't go and sit in on a common ground thing. You go and sit in on, either they want to play one of your songs, or they want you to play one of their songs, which you may not know, but you just have to at that point figure out how to make musically fit into what they're going to play. Which in my case, I don't have a problem with that, you know. The majority of the times when I go sit in with people, they always want to play, you know, one of the meter songs, you know, which I'd be trying to say, man, let's play something else, man. Call it something else, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I play this shit all the time. You know?
Right.
It's called something else, man, you know.
You like the challenge of trying new stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, for the most part, man, you know, I appreciate that. You know, I appreciate the respect that be handed to me by all of the younger players, you know. I really do. You know, but most of the time when I'm going out and set in, you know, it's like, you know, they got a certain group of songs that everybody play. And I get sick of playing the doggone songs, you know. You know, they would say, man, I've been playing that song for 40 some odd years, right? Don't you know something else?
Right, right, exactly. You played with Snooks for so many years, and what was that experience like?
You know, I mean, if you play with Snooks, there's one thing that you will know, is that before the gig is over, you're going to be in play at least 3 or 4 songs you never heard before in your life. There was one night he played that. I saw that particular night came up again on YouTube here recently. Came back to haunt me again. Little Ray Charles song. He called the changes to the song. You know, he was singing it and calling the changes to him the whole doggone tune. It was the funniest thing. It's funny as hell, but it was like, whoa, okay, Snooks, I got it now, you know, but he just kept calling the changes.
How'd you first meet Snooks?
I want to say that I met Snooks earlier than the Blacktop session days. It might have been when I played a little time. I did some things with Professor Long here. I think maybe that's when the Snooks first came into my sights. But at that point, we wasn't playing. Snooks gig, we was playing a Professor Longhair gig. Guess it probably was the Blacktop thing that kind of brought Snooks and I together on stage together. And then at that point when we did those records, Jazz Fest, you know, started asking me to put together the bands to back Snooks on Jazz Fest. Mm-hmm. And when we first started doing it, I was using the big horn section. I would use the running partners, you know, the full horns, the horns and stuff with him. And we would be doing arrangements that were on, you know, those first 3 records that I recorded with Snooks. So I took Snooks to Japan with me one time. Well, it was basically the bio wanted Snooks, and they contacted me, and I put the band behind to back him up. Then we ended up over there recording a live record that, you know, that, again, got and got interest in the U.S. and Jazz Fest, you know, I put together the smaller version of the band, and now I was playing it with a five-piece band. One of the things that I wanted to get done before he passed away, I started working on, I wrote some music for him. I wrote two songs that was on his last album that I recorded with him,
mm-hmm.
Awesome Funk and Answer Now Baby. But I started writing a whole record that was going to be, you know, I wrote all the music, and the only thing I left away from the music was lyrics and or melodies, you know. There were some of the songs that was going to be, I'm thinking that the album more than likely would have been more instrumentally than lyrical, but then, you know, but I was also talking with Miss Leslie Smith about writing some lyrics, you know, good simple blues lyrics that, you know, that ain't whine or crying, you know, for the record. So, you know, I had this project in mind to work with Snooks on, so he can get at least one record out that had all Snooks Evening material, you know, mm-hmm. I'm assuming he's split the writing up, you know, and everything. So he had an album that had his name on it, was his music, you know what I'm saying? Fuck that human jukebox thing on him, I hated that, you know?
Yeah.
If it was feeding his family, so, I mean, that's, you know, I understand, you know, doing what you got to do to feed the family, you know? And if that's what the record label was, how the record label was making their money, taking all these public domain tunes and having Snooks re-record them, you know? And that was the way it was. I had no control over that.
Who would you like to work with that you haven't worked with yet?
You know what? I know what I'd like to, what I really would like to do is I would like to record a jazz record. I would really want to cut a bebop record. You know, I would try look into the local community and see if I find some young musicians that, you know, and first thing come to mind is some of my cousins, you know, the Marcellus definitely would call for Bradford, you know, I know Bradford can play bebop. We hadn't worked on a project together. He came in at the Warren Hands Christmas Jam and jammed with PBS a couple of years ago. Well, it actually wasn't PBS, it was the Funky Meters at that time.
Uh-huh.
Stokes was still in the band. That was fun. I'm not sure, you know, they got tons and tons of players out there. That young drummer, Steve Kimmock's son, this kid is killing. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to be able to do a project with him. This point in time right now, I might as well tell you this song. I just recorded 16 songs, which my favorite Meter songs that was never played.
Nice.
They were all recorded by the Meters. They were on Meter Records. But like we said earlier, you know, when you do some music that you can't perform live,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they don't get, you know, or they just don't seem to be your favorite of the 12 tracks, you know. They get kind of ignored. Well, the Meters have, you know, recorded 122 songs, 126 songs, and I think we only played maybe 30 of them, you know. So I picked my favorite 16 out of that, you know, out of that remaining 100 some odd songs, and I just finished recording them with Running Partners with the five-piece version of the band. Man, I'm enjoying it. I'm not sure if you had a chance to go to georgeporterjr.com and download two of the tracks. I put them up for Jazz Fest.
Did you take different approach to the tunes?
Yes, I did. I took a completely, totally different approach to them, but yes, I did. I did take a fresh approach to the tunes, yeah. They're still pretty much, they're meter songs, and I Porter is them a little bit, you know. Two that's up on the thing, you know, because two that's up on the thing. One of the songs was sort of less like a rhythm track. Like I said, the rhythm track, like Waiting for a Head. I had Chris Royal, saxophone player with the five-piece band. He wrote a head for the song, so there's now a saxophone melody on top of this song, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is killing, you know.
It must be nice to, like, flesh out some of those old-school songs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was fun, man. It was fun. And, you know, and what I enjoyed about it was that the band embraced these tunes so well. It was, you know, it's like, and they were tunes that, you know, that I had presented to the original Meters when we did the reunion in 2000. Presented these, I presented 22 songs to the Meters to play. I said, man, we're doing this reunion, man. Let's do this reunion and play some shit we ain't never played, you know. And the band threw it out. They said, no way, man. The people want to hear us play, you know, the hits. I said, man, screw the hits. You know, man, the people been hearing everybody play those songs for the last 30 years. Let's play something they haven't heard, you know. And they wouldn't do it, you know. I said, all right, don't worry about it.
Do you have a favorite rarely played meter song?
Rarely played meter song?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I think if I got a favorite one, it was a tune called The Mob. It was a killer track, you know. And nobody would fool with it, but the Running Point is there. And it's good.
What sort of advice would you give to, like, up-and-coming musicians?
You know, man, advice is a dime a dozen these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's any advice to be had, you know, if you're going to get in this business to earn money and, you know, and learn the business, you know, mm-hmm. if you're just going to get in this business just to have fun and enjoy playing and stuff like that, I still say learn the business because, you know, just doing it just to have fun and playing and enjoying what you're doing, you know, you may start doing something that's really good, and somebody's going to see that, and they may want to start doing things. You know, last thing, man, is, you know, don't sign no piece of paper that you don't understand. Don't sign nothing that even when you got a lawyer telling you, oh, yeah, this is okay, mm-hmm. you know. It's still, I mean, I'm saying that because I'm going through that shit right now, man. You know, I had a lawyer tell me that some shit was right, and boy, it was so wrong, you know. And I'm fighting for my life. I'm 62 years old. The troubles I'm having at 62, the shit I was supposed to have at 26. At 26, I had similar kind of things like this. It never got to where it is now. I mean, at 62 years old, I'm supposed to be really enjoying what I'm doing, you know, mm-hmm. not trying to figure out how I'm going to save my home or lose my vehicles or some stuff like that because of some piece of paper that lied from the get-go, you know, from start. You know, the piece of paper was wrong from start. Mm-hmm. People who told me that it was good didn't know what they were talking about. I don't write contracts. So you got to trust somebody to read a contract to you, you know, and tell you what to hear and there and two fours mean, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That person you choose to read that contract don't have a clue, then, you know, they just screwed you, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
My advice, don't sign no people, man, you know? And managers come and go, you know, and I think, man, your life is probably much better without one. You know, 3 years ago, I signed a contract with a manager that's fucking me, you know?
Oh, man.
And, you know, it's like the guy's trying to take my home, he's trying to take my car, he wants my base, you know, he wants everything. He wants to fucking hang me out to dry, you know? That's all because, you know, I took some bad information. I took some information that was, you know, that was bad from another attorney that I thought that knew what he was talking about, you know. Mm-hmm. And now at 62 years old, I'm fighting for my life, you know.